So by way of ground rules, I like to do these in a way to prove to you that, because I always do these manuscript sermons, actually I can respond improvisationally. And also when you have a week like I did, I was, last 2 weeks I've been trying to land a job for next year. And interviewed with like 6 different committees, and then you got to study. It's kind of a lot going on. While you were contemplating whether or not you were going to call Reverend Jason Cook, I was trying to figure out if I could keep working. So I landed a 1-year interim ministry in Rancho Palos Verdes, so I'm very happy with that. And I had, a certain amount of interest. I mean, it wasn't, oh, I was lucky to just land that, though I was, but I felt like I had choices, so thank you. So here's what I do. When I do these in a settled ministry, you can't answer them all. And I say, well, I'll try to answer the others along the way through the next year. Well, I'll try to answer whatever. I don't get to. I've only got 5 times, but that's an inducement to come if I don't answer your question. What does it mean to love alike? Is that an imperative? So there's that right here that we put up every Sunday, and it's a quote from Francis David, who was a Unitarian martyr, very early Unitarian martyr in what I guess is now Hungary. And that was one of his quotes. It was an area under King John Sigismund, I think 1580s, that they had the first edict of religious tolerance, but all that was, Francis David was caught up in that. And to this day, around Transylvania, Eastern Europe, the Polish contingent of Socinians got wiped out. But to this day, there's a lot of contention. There's Catholics, there's Lutherans, there's all kinds of. And David basically was burned to stake for a few things, turning the mass around, which they now do, offering the cup to the laity, which they now do, but then it was bad news for him. And he said this, what does it mean to love alike? Is it imperative? Well, no, I think what it means is, you know, you can think about all these things and get caught up in doctrine, but most of us know when we feel love, you know, around your children, usually around you know, that rush of romantic love, but also these feelings of deep compassion for others that just spring out of us. I think that's what he was trying to get into. Is it imperative? No, I mean, none of the 7 principles are imperatives. They're aspirations. They're what we hold up as worthy of our love, as worthy of our attention, worthy of our focus and concentration. So loving alike means, you know, it's easy to love your family, but here's the hard part. You know, it's easy to love your family because you know them and you care for them. But how do you love, you know, people that seem alien or different race, you know? Now there's all this hoopla about transgender bathrooms, you know? Nobody going to the bathroom next to transgender people for years, you know? Nobody said word one about it or even knew. And now I was like, whoa, well, to my way of thinking, that's what Francis David is talking about. So why is music one of the most spiritual art forms in the world? Why is it that people feel most connected to the divine when they hear music? I don't know, but that would fit my mother to a T. She's very much an agnostic, so I would say, right to the end. And her mother was when she married a non-Catholic, was drummed out of the Catholic Church, had no truck for religion whatsoever, and my favorite grandparent. But I remember her talking about hearing Caruso, and she started crying. And as a young man, I sang Handel's Messiah, and I can't hear it without having a profound emotional experience. And my mom, you know, she had tickets to the orchestra in Cleveland. It was a good orchestra. She would come back, you know, her hanky all wet. Now, and it wasn't a depressive view of the divine. It was a redemptive view. It was an emotional, cathartic experience And I find myself in, you know, Robert, when the church I grew up in, Robert Shaw was the minister of music, so they had very excellent music. And I was trained to like it, and as the minister, it's the one part of the service where I can really let go and just experience emotionally, not worry, close my eyes. And so I don't know. I mean, why is that? I mean, it affects your central nervous system. It doesn't, you can't think it out. Why does the Messiah make me cry? I mean, I know the words kind of in Latin. I have an idea what they mean, but I was a very poor Latin student, so. I don't have to be a good Latin student to have the emotional and spiritual experience. And that is why people love it. And all of us who grew up in the 60s, I mean, Motown, you know, I discovered at 15, you know, what a liberation. And then the Beatles and Dylan and all that music. You want, what's Eric Burden? You want to find the truth in life? Don't pass music by. And you know, I would not lie down at Monterey. 1967 pop. So you don't have to go to the Cleveland Orchestra to have an experience of profound emotional connection to the source. And that's for those who believe, how do we worship or celebrate God within our UU tradition? Well, our UU tradition, see, we were the descending tradition within Christianity. So we have this interesting relationship to Orthodoxy of being in connection with it, but not swallowing it whole cloth, but being in dialectical relation with it, critique relationship with it. And so you don't have to be a Christian. Now, how do you celebrate if you believe? Well, you find ways to encourage what makes you believe. If you have intimations of immortality, you use William Wordsworth, poetic. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower, that's Dylan Thomas, right. These poetic, and when you see them and you feel them, find ways to keep it alive in your heart. John Adams said to his son, John Quincy, at 21, off to be, I think it was, ambassador to Russia, gave him a little book. He said, it's a poetry. He said, you're never alone with a poet in your pocket. And he would read that to inspire him when he felt alienated or alone or confused or over his head. Well, I do the same with the Psalms. I do the same with Lao Tzu. And there are other ways, you know, you can develop, you know, you don't have to call it prayer life, creative visualization techniques. And you put, it's a practice. You know, you develop practices that keep these insights or aspirations close to you. Don't dispense them and put them in the drawer and neglect them if you can. So, you know, what Archbishop Tutu in South Africa, he said, well, I meditate an hour every morning. And when things are really heavy, I meditate 2 hours. I don't do that. But I try to meditate about 20 minutes a day. And I definitely do walking, which is a somatic meditation, which Thoreau writes about at length. Do you have some kind of a sermon that you have heard down the years? But I've heard some good sermons. Dave Rankin was one of my teachers. Carl Scovel, Roy Phillips, Barbara Merritt, these people are great preachers. And you can read their preaching and you get good ideas. I have a couple of things Rankin did years ago that I still want to elaborate on. They were great. Yeah. He did one on, I read a book on Stalin's daughter, I forget her name, you know, and I remember Papa, so powerful, you know, and this beautiful story about this little girl remembering her indulgent, sweet, curmudgeonous dad. And at the end, you find out she's talking about Joe Stalin.
That's why we've got to learn how to love beyond just our families. Wyatt said.
Where am I going? Palos Verdes. What's the difference between the spirit and the soul? Well, they're the same thing. I mean, according to Blake, you know, according to Whitman, the soul is another word for the spirit, for the body. Body is another word for the soul. But we think, we can only think with the subject predicate distinction. We can only talk, and thinking follows our talking. So everything is bifurcated, like your call to lighting of the candle. And so, yeah, spirit, soul. If you look it up in some dictionaries, I think Collier's, it will say, well, the spirit is non-corporeal. That is, it's not of the body. So, well, Whitman never thought that. Blake and the mystics don't. They're together, but we are... Natural language has us separate them. Good, evil, body, spirit, male, female. When they're really all... Yes, there's way... You know, what's the yin and yang? Alma says an explicit duality, implicit unity. But the implicit can't be articulated. We can have a mystical experience. That's why I go to meditation. Meditate for 20 minutes every day, or an hour, like Bishop Tutu, because it'll open that and clear it, and you'll be able to believe or understand beyond thought. But like my grandmother crying about Caruso, she didn't think about it; she just knew it. Do I feel free to express your political as well as your religious experiences during the service? How? Well, you know, I try to answer religious questions more, and then how that coming out of that inspires our progressivity politically, as opposed to talk politics and kind of try to link that to some what Emerson said. And I do, so I tend to focus a little more on the spiritual dimensions. I think a lot of our churches neglect that more than perhaps I would think is best. But, you know, my other mentor, Paul Sawyer, was always out in the streets. Every worship service was about political engagement. So, that's another way to go. I feel more free expressing my spiritual views than political, because you know you think that these EU churches are all liberal Democrats, but they're not. And people who are not liberal progressive Democrats don't share their opinions so much. All right, I served a church in Massachusetts; more than half were Republican. Now, Massachusetts Republicans are not like Texas Republicans, and they never were. You know, Elliot Richardson and the like, but. The political, you know, I feel, you know, I'm an open book, you know, I'm extraordinarily, you know, left wing. I think I'm more liberal than radical on most things, but it's getting to the point where a radical response might be all we can do to keep the planet, you know, healthy. Who most influenced my ministry? Spiritual leader, my professor John Mattingly, the classics professor, is really my mentor. Picture, I mean, because well, it's just too long. I hardly talk about him because I feel it's so personal, and the level of, you know, he introduced me to the life of the mind. He introduced me and made me understand what the soul was, really, and how we all had one. We were all linked there. And then I could understand Emerson and all that, but he was a classicist. I mean, he was ostensibly an Episcopalian. I don't think he ever went to church once. And he turned me on to Plato and the Greeks, Jesus, I mean, the Buddha, these great people, Lao Tzu, I mentioned, they're fabulous. And many of our UU martyrs and heroes. What's been my biggest challenge as interim? Well, you have to say goodbye. You have to leave. You know, you fall in love with these people. Love them and leave them. That's the job. And you do. You fall in love with people. And I look at you. I love you. Some of you I really have gone through some stuff with, you know, who availed yourself of my pastoral attention or just happened to be touched by that. And you get very close. And then the protocol, and it makes very good sense. I have to say goodbye. I'll see you. Sayonara. You know. And you'll see me at district events. I look forward to that. It's very hard. There's a lot, in the ministry in general, there's a lot of unexpressed grief. People you love die, move away. Programs you tried to get rolling didn't work. Things have to be abandoned. And people quit. And sometimes promising opportunities sour. If you're really pushing and moving along. So that's always part of it. But in this interim thing, it's like it's just, they make it happen fast. And sometimes they ask you, you guys asked me to bring you up to speed so you could be a regular bona fide UU church after being led for 20 plus years by someone who wasn't in fellowship. That's been easy. You're the least resistant to change congregation I've ever served. And I really want to commend you for that. And part of it, I know I'm better. I don't beat people up and make them change and threaten them and stuff like when I was younger. I'm better at it. And you know, charming it out of people and nudging them along and all. But, you were charmable, nudgeable, even threatenable. So I want to thank you because it's a wonderful thing to have. It's a wonderful attribute. Do I have a UU elevator speech? Not really. That's why I get these jobs, so I can go on and on and on. I do, but I'm not going to bore you. You know, it's just, I've always tried to say, hey, we've been around. We're not a cult. I don't say that, but, you know, come out of the Puritan tradition. You know. In fact, the Plymouth Church is Unitarian. We draw inspiration from all faiths. We have a special relationship to the radical edge of the Protestant Reformation. Yeah. They say, well, what about Jesus? They say, oh, well, we're universalists. Christ is here. The resurrection is now. And yes, I've been saved. That's it. Next. Come to my church. Here's my card. So, why do you seem like pop culture is more interesting in celebrating evil than heroes? Well, evils are more attractive. Evil's more attractive. Evil's very seductive. I mean, still, I say the evil that I see wears the cloak of respectability. Evil has a Gucci's on and a $3,000 suit, and they look good. And they'll, you know, and I say one of the things, I don't know, it's just too cynical, but people sell out to the degree to which they're invited to. You know, most of my fraternity brothers at this little college back east went to Smith Barney and Solomon Brown, and they're doing great, you know. Are they evil? No, not. But are they caught up? You know, at that same age, I thought, what am I going to devote my life energy to, making rich old men richer? No. No. I won't. And, but it's very attractive, especially in some of the hardest times in ministry. So why did I do it? You know, when you look at the situation, good is humble, as I see it. It doesn't draw attention to itself, usually. It's in the margins. It's helping people relate, you know, and it involves, Emerson said there's no limit to what you can accomplish if you don't have to take credit for it. Good in people are helping things happen without insisting on credit. And good institutions do the job without a whole lot of fanfare. And, you know, how do you be part of one of those? And then when you do it, how do you keep yourself fed, nourished by it? And then there's some about Star Wars and the Stormtroopers. Yeah, they look great. I mean, the Nazis look great. I'm fascinated with them. Those sharp uniforms and they're all in order. But To what end? To what end? You know, very desperate, in hateful, destructive end. So, but you have to recognize it does look cool sometimes, a lot of times. What makes a good sermon, and how would I know? What's the best part of being a serial interminster? That sounds sinister, doesn't it? What makes a good sermon? Well, in our tradition, you do need to speak to the intellectual dimensions, because we have always had that. You know, keep critical thinking, keep your thinking cap on. But you want to touch the heart. Not everybody's ordered that way. Many of our people are. And so I try to include that. But mostly, a good sermon is a powerful image, like that Dave Rankin sermon of I Remember Papa, that the revelation, these charming stories about this sweet daddy, mother's dead, dad is just as soft as touch, and then you find out who the guy is. Whoa. I mean, but then you learn about something profound about people in that. That's one sermon. It still affects me. And Rankin had quite a few. Good image. You get an image. It won't let go. As I say, sometimes I like to try to crack open these metaphors. So we did around Passover. What is passing over and how that happens. And crack them open and go, oh yeah, it's a metaphor. It's happening right now. It's here. It's not about something back in Egypt. It's happening right now in Orange County. Anyway, that's a good sermon. Your touch and either something profound about the human condition comes right through into how I carry on this week. That's a good sermon. And do I measure up? I don't know. I try. I keep at it. And I appreciate when people thank me for what I am trying to do. And I appreciate when people critique me, because I know I can always be better. But in all honesty, I've been at this 36 years, and at this point, I'm pretty convinced that no matter how good you are, some people aren't in the mood to hear you that day. That some people fell asleep at the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, I don't know why UU supports helping illegal immigrants who jump the line to enter our country ahead of those long-waiting people going through the correct channels to enter legally. Well, that's a complex thing, and I am trying to figure my way through it, too. Our denomination, by virtue of resolutions passed at General Assembly, has been very supportive of immigrant rights. I think when people are terribly. I mean, my great ancestor wrote the Mayflower Compact. Here's the thing. I'm a 13th descendant of William Brewster. He wrote the darn thing. I'm a complete believer in immigrant rights and helping people come to America, new citizens. My ancestors did it. When I was in New Mexico, Mary Ellen Gonzalez had relatives who were European descended, who were in New Mexico before my people were in Massachusetts, but she agreed with me. Yes, that's part of the American thing. That's part of our story, the myth, the energy, the tradition, what we do. We let new people in, just like our ancestors did, because we were slaves in Egypt, and somebody helped us find a way, all right? Is it Yahweh? Well, in our tradition, it's through the hands and hearts and of others. That's where Yahweh is most consistently revealed. And if we can be instruments of those hands, certainly I can't lend my energy. And I'll take the Constitution whole cloth, but I don't want to lend my personal energy into excluding people and asking, no, go away, get in line. We're going to build a huge wall. There's got to be a better way, a more just way. People that are, especially these refugees, you know. How many of your ancestors fled the Prussian-Franco War? They weren't going to be conscripted. I'm sure there's 11 great-grandparents, right here, great-great-great-grandparents, who did that. And now we say, oh, well, I don't know, it doesn't look too violent to me down in Guatemala. Check it out. So, but it is complex, and I'm trying to emigrate to Australia. I've got my visa in, it's been in for almost a year. It's going to be in probably for another year. Plus, I got to pay a lot of money. So I have some appreciation for those who are going the legal route. But I can get there the legal route. I have ways to get there. And if I had my daughter, my 3-year-old daughter, when I left California to go to Connecticut, I put her in the car seat and we drove. Okay? If I were in Guatemala, I couldn't do that. But that little girl deserves a chance. And most of you would want to take it too if you were in Syria. So these are human questions. Can a Unitarian be a fundamentalist? Yeah, we have fundamentalists of the left. The ministers call them what? Shiite humanists? It becomes a dogma. So the people say, well, you can't say God in a UU church. That's nonsense. What do you mean? God, that guy doesn't believe in, I don't believe in either, never did. But you can be a fundamentalist. Anybody can be a fundamentalist when the letter of the law is more important than the spirit. That's our thing, There's St. Paul letter to the Roman, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. And Emerson, Thoreau, the transcendentalist, the transient permanence, so that's Theodore Parker. The transient is all these forms. The permanent is the spirit of Jesus as a healing, transformational element in culture. It's getting late. Every other one I will answer in the next 5 weeks. I'll somehow weave it in if I can. And I thank you. These are all good. Some of them are too theoretical. But I've answered more than that. Thank you.